Yet another attempt by the United Nations Security Council to get a ceasefire in place or even an agreement to stop the violence by the government. Another high-level defection by a Syrian diplomat. It suggested once again the Assad regime may be on the brink. The Syrian ambassador to Iraq, a prominent member of the ruling Ba'ath Party, called for his colleagues to join what he called the Syrian Revolution. He called on the regime to halt its violence against the Syrian people.
The escalation of violence, allow me to say, to an unprecedented level, obstructed our ability to observe, to verify, to report, as well as to assist in local dialogue.
That there is the voice of Major General Robert Mood of Norway. He's the officer commanding the United Nations monitoring effort in Syria. He spoke in Damascus last week about how difficult the limited UN monitoring mission in Syria has been in the midst of all the violence. Joining us now is Donatella Rivera, Amnesty International's senior crisis response advisor. She's recently written a 69-page report called Deadly Reprisals, describing the conditions inside Syria after spending considerable time in more than a dozen Syrian cities and villages. Donatella, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
First of all, what is it like to get in and out and to even move around inside of Syria in this environment, and thinking about what Major General Robert Mood said? He's a blue hat. He can go anywhere, ostensibly.
I went into Syria without government authorization, illegally, so to speak.
Sure.
And moving around depends on the area. The government forces control the main roads, but it's possible to move and to go pretty much anywhere in the country, going via small agricultural roads, small path. So that's possible.
If I'm sitting in one of the small villages that you visited, if I'm a Syrian citizen, how do I view this war against the citizens by the regime? Do I fear the government? Do I fear a particular faction of the government? Do I fear the local police constabulary? Are they the ones that are scaring me?
No, generally, it's not been the local police. It's been the forces that have sort of swept into villages and towns. Forces and militias, the Shabiha, which are armed by the state and are operating alongside the security forces. And it's been different units of the Syrian army, military security, the state security, the intelligence services. But certainly not the local police, no.
Is there any attraction for people to join the Shabiha? Is there an incentive that the government offers, or is it purely out of loyalty that they're enforcing this militia and sort of warlord force that's going out against these villages and cities?
It's a bit difficult to know, because obviously, you know, we have no access to talk to these people. But certainly, I mean, the Shabiha militia used to be sort of more criminal gangs that are now being paid to do part of the government dirty work. So it seems to be a mixture of loyalty and sort of monetary incentive.
What do people in the villages want the world to know about what's going on in their country? And how do they use you as a way of getting their message out?
I was in 23 villages and cities, and it was in the wake of particularly brutal military operation by the army. People were very, very scared, but they also wanted the world to know what was happening to them. They were asking why the international community has virtually deserted them. That is the bit that people just don't understand. They look at sort of Libya and other places, and I think there was an expectation at the beginning of the uprising that the international community would do something, and certainly they see it on their television screen that, you know, the international community is having meetings and, you know, sending in a UN force, and then they really don't see any difference on their daily life.
Do people believe that it is Russia that's holding this together, that it is Russia that is financing or arming the government, or that it is Iran that is somehow keeping this going? Or is it Bashar Assad's personality and force of will, certainly his father, an extraordinarily formidable character down through history?
At the level of ordinary people, there is a bit of that. Certainly, Syria and Iran are well-known ally of the Syrian regime. But people also, in a way, hold the international community in its entirety responsible, because they just can't believe that if there was a real will to do something to help them, that it wouldn't be possible to do so.
If I was in one of the 23 villages and cities that you were in, who would I meet? Tell me some people that you spoke with, families who are so vulnerable and who yearn simply for this to end.
Wherever I went, that, you know, that's what I was doing. I was investigating the crimes that had been committed. So I met so many families. For example, in a village north of Aleppo in Anadan, I spoke to a family where seven members of the family, four brothers and their three cousins, were killed in their home. They were shot dead in their home when the army swept through the village. And then their bodies were set on fire. One of the brothers who had managed to hide in a nearby place came back and found the body still smoldering. This is now means that seven entire families of this extended family are now so full of hatred towards the regime. And that is the tragedy of the failure of the international community to have done anything to address this situation much earlier on, a year ago, when it was less complex and it would have been realistically more possible to do so.
You entitled your report Deadly Reprisals. I'm wondering if that's where the politics begins in Syria, if Assad ever does go, that you begin with a kind of revenge politics that will settle all of these scores that you've described in your visits to these villages.
This is certainly the great danger, because we're already beginning to see that to some extent, some aspect of that now happening. There are cases already that have been happening when members of the Shabiha, a member of the Syrian army, are captured by the armed opposition. They are tortured. In some cases, they're killed. So it hasn't been a question of civil war until now. The monopoly has been firmly in the hand. The monopoly of violence has been firmly in the hands of the government. But certainly in the same way as the government has gone really big in sort of reprisal and revenge to intimidate and sort of force the community into submission, there is certainly a danger that with more and more hatred building up every day at the atrocities being committed by government forces and militia, that there will be a revenge if and when things change.
A growing legacy of hatred and possible revenge if there is to be a next stage in Syria. Donatella Rivera is Senior Crisis Response Advisor for Amnesty International. Thank you so much.
We were just speaking with Donatella Rivera. She is the author of a 69-page report. It's called Deadly Reprisals, that describes the conditions in Syria based on her visits to 20 Syrian villages over the last several months. And joining us now, Fareed Ghadri, Syrian-born co-founder and president of the United States-based Reform Party of Syria, which is lobbying for regime change. Thank you so much for joining us, Fareed.
Thank you for having me.
You know, one of the things that Donatella said that struck me is that perhaps equally with the Assad regime, the people of Syria seem to be blaming the international community, saying you helped Libya, you helped Egypt to a certain extent, and if the UN or Western nations wanted the violence to end in Syria, it would.
Yes, that is correct. The sense Syrians have, and I've been talking to many of them inside the country, is that why the international community is not coming to our assistance. And many of them are starting to direct their anger in the forms that Ms. Rivera has mentioned. And by the way, thank you for Amnesty International. They've done a wonderful job in terms of reporting the atrocities. And many of them are turning their anger towards the West, but also they're turning into extremist elements, into elements of revenge, into people who are just desperate, and this is not good for Syria, future of Syria, and certainly not good for the region. So we inaction has caused problems, and will continue if we stay on the sideline.
And yet, you know, for a very long time, for months and months, many Syrian people, the members of the opposition, had said they did not want military intervention from outside nations. What kind of intervention were they hoping for from the international community if it wasn't military in nature?
Well, from the get-go, we wanted, when the Free Syrian Army started forming and the factions happened, we wanted the Obama administration to help arm the rebels, arm the Free Syrian Army, for themselves to free themselves and to defend themselves. But that has not happened. And so they've turned to other people, other means, smuggling of arms, and the killing continued. To reinforce what Ms. Rivera was saying, there's one of the biggest brigades right now in Syria is called the Farouk Brigade. The deputy of the leader of that Farouk Brigade had his family, 17 members, die in 1 hour in Bab Amr in Homs. 17 members in 1 hour, he saw them dead. And that's the kind of tragedy that is gripping Syria today. And it's very hard to stop these people, very hard to tell them, we need to take a better route. We don't need to take revenge. We need to be better than they are. And that's the message I keep sending to them. But it's very hard to tell someone whose family has been totally disseminated to hold off of revenge and to be more civil. It's really a tragedy today.
Fari Ghadri is a Syrian-born co-founder and president of the United States-based Reform Party of Syria, lobbying for regime change in Syria. Thank you so much, Farid.
Thank you for having me.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.